the digital station for comedy, drama, and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now we begin Elizabeth's Women by Tracy Borman, a biography of Elizabeth I told through the women who influenced her life. In today's extract, the impact on the future queen of the life and death of her mother, Anne Boleyn, will be explored. The reader is Emma Fielding.
Giovanni Michiel, the Venetian ambassador to England during Bloody Mary Tudor's reign, noted that the queen's younger sister, Elizabeth, is proud and haughty, although she knows that she was born of such a mother. Clearly, he believed that the Lady Elizabeth ought to be ashamed of being the offspring of Henry VIII's disgraced second wife, the infamous Anne Boleyn, who had usurped the place of Queen Mary's mother, Catherine of Aragon. Her subsequent alleged infidelities had led to her execution and to her only child, Elizabeth, being declared a bastard. Yet here she was, displaying all the traits with which Anne had so beguiled King Henry. And her coal black eyes were an uncomfortable reminder that for all her Tudor traits, most notably her abundant red hair, she was very much her mother's daughter. Anne Boleyn was formally recognised as queen on the 12th of April, 1533, and her coronation followed 6 weeks later. This was a lavish affair, full of iconography and symbolism, designed to emphasise the legitimacy of her position and her suitability as queen. The coronation was also a test of the loyalty of the court and the people. Most were there under duress, and bitterly resented the woman whom they viewed as a usurper. Furthermore, this new queen was very obviously pregnant, and further advanced than one might expect for a lady who'd been married for barely 4 months. Although she triumphed in the expectation of giving Henry a son and heir, Anne complained about the loss of her figure. She no doubt feared that as her attractiveness waned, the king would seek diversion elsewhere. Her fears were well grounded. In August 1533, as Anne had entered the 8th month of her pregnancy, rumours of a secret liaison between the king and a very beautiful woman began to spread. Just a few short months before, Anne had been the sole focus of the king's attention, the woman whom he had worshipped for years and moved heaven and earth to attain. In the middle of August, Henry and Anne moved to Windsor, and from there to Greenwich, the king's favourite palace, which had been appointed for Anne's confinement, or lying in. A queen's confinement was subject to an elaborate set of conventions. These dictated that a queen would effectively go into seclusion before the birth was expected. She would be confined to a suite of rooms, where an oratory would be installed, so that prayers could add necessary succour in an age when knowledge of obstetrics was limited, together with a font to provide a quick baptism for a sickly baby. The room in which she wished to give birth would be hung with heavy tapestries depicting scenes from romances or other pleasant subjects so as not to upset mother or child. The floor would be laid all over with thick carpets, and even the keyholes would be blocked up to keep out any glimmer of light. The final touch was the installation of two cradles, one a great cradle of estate, richly upholstered with crimson cloth of gold, the other a more modest carved wooden cradle painted with gold. The whole effect was designed to impress, but it would also have been stifling and oppressive for those within, with its heavy tapestries that shut out all light, made worse still by braziers and rich perfumes that filled the air from the unstoppered bottles scattered around the room. On the 26th of August, Anne formally took to her chamber. As custom dictated, she heard Mass in the palace chapel before hosting a banquet for all the lords and ladies of the court. Soon afterwards, she was escorted to the door of her bedchamber by two high-ranking ladies. Here, she took formal leave not just of the king, but of all the male courtiers, and entered an exclusively female world. All of this was intended to emphasize that childbirth was a purely female mystery. In a male-dominated society, this was the only sphere in which women held precedence. On the 7th of September, the eve of the Feast of the Virgin, Anne went into labour. And shortly after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the baby was born. The child was not the hoped-for prince. It was a girl. After all the turmoil that the king and his country had endured to attain an heir, this was surely a disaster. But the king, on the surface at least, showed little of the fury that historians have since assigned to him. Upon visiting his newborn daughter for the first time, he remarked to the queen that as they were both still young, they might confidently expect to have sons in due course. He then announced that the girl would be named Elizabeth, after both his mother and Anne's. But Elizabeth's birth had significantly weakened Anne's position. Within weeks, Henry had summoned his illegitimate son, Henry Fitzroy, home from France. Either he wanted to make a statement that he could father sons, or, more worryingly for Anne, he planned to keep the boy in reserve, in case she failed in her duty. After everything Anne had been through, it would be logical to assume that she felt more than a degree of bitterness towards Elizabeth. But she lavished affection upon her, and could hardly bear to be apart from her. When she returned to court after her confinement, courtiers looked on in astonishment as Anne carefully set the baby down on a velvet cushion next to her throne. However, Anne knew full well that she would not be able to keep Elizabeth with her. The child would have to be set up in her own establishment, as tradition dictated. Henry had appointed the Palace of Hatfield, some 20 miles from London, as the most suitable place. When Elizabeth was barely 3 months old, she was removed to Hatfield in all due state. There was a wet nurse to suckle her, and 4 rockers to attend her in her cradle, as well as numerous other ladies to nurse, bathe, amuse, and protect her. During those 3 short months at Greenwich, Anne had forged an extremely close bond with Elizabeth, doting on her in public and showering her with gifts. This went beyond maternal affection. Young as she was, Elizabeth was an ally against Anne's enemies at court, for she symbolised her mother's fertility and thus the hope of future children. She was also the king's only legitimate heir. Anne used her influence to ensure that her daughter would be surrounded by members of the Boleyn family. Margaret Boucher, Lady Bryan, the half-sister of her mother, was appointed Elizabeth's lady mistress. Elizabeth spent much of her early childhood moving from palace to palace. For the most part, her mother was obliged to keep track of her well-being by letter rather than visits, for she was greatly preoccupied with court affairs, not to mention the pressure to produce a male heir. Within months of Elizabeth's birth, Anne had fallen pregnant again, but all the renewed hope of an heir was crushed when the child was stillborn. Then, during the summer progress of 1535, she fell pregnant once more. Surely it would be a case of third time lucky. Although delighted at his wife's condition, Henry could not disguise the distaste that he had come to feel for her. Courtiers noticed that in private, he shrank from her. Anne was tormented by jealousy, knowing full well that her husband was pursuing Jane Seymour. As the new year arrived, things turned more decisively in Anne's favour. On the 8th of January 1536, Catherine of Aragon, the woman whom most of England still regarded as the rightful queen, died. Henry and Anne were overjoyed. This enduring challenge to the legitimacy of their marriage had finally disappeared for good. The king immediately ordered great festivities. A delighted young Elizabeth was summoned from Hatfield, and Anne looked on in triumph as Henry lifted their daughter in his arms and proudly paraded her in front of the court. Barely 3 weeks later, disaster struck. On the 29th of January, Anne discovered her husband cavorting with Jane Seymour. She raged and lashed out in an increasing frenzy. That evening, overcome with fevered exhaustion, she miscarried. This time, God had surely shown his hand, for the 15-week-old fetus had all the appearance of being a boy. Things now began to unravel rapidly for Anne. This second miscarriage convinced Henry that their marriage had offended God, and that for as long as it continued, God would deny him the male heir that he so craved. The king now switched his attentions firmly to his new mistress. It was upon Elizabeth that Anne now lavished all her affection. During those bleak early months of 1536, Anne busied herself with ordering pretty clothes for her infant daughter. In April, she was overjoyed when the king agreed that the child could visit her at Greenwich. Anne sought Elizabeth's company a great deal during this time, playing with her and dressing her in the new velvet frocks and satin caps. But all the while, the king's chief minister, Thomas Cromwell, was quietly gathering evidence that would rid his master of Anne's irksome presence for good. Finally, on the first day of May, the minister confronted Henry. Outraged, the king ordered that his wife's alleged lovers be thrown into the Tower. The news spread like wildfire, and soon it reached the ears of the queen herself. Gathering her daughter in her arms, she ran to the king, desperate to convince him of her innocence. If Anne had used her daughter in a last attempt to save her own life, it was in vain. On the 19th of May, 1536, as Anne stood on the scaffold at the Tower, she gave a last dignified speech to the hushed crowds. Rather than bemoaning her fate, she was full of praise for the king, lauding him as one of the best princes on the face of the earth. That she chose to praise him could have been to protect those whom she left behind, none more so than Elizabeth, who had been rendered illegitimate by the dissolving of Henry's marriage to Anne. Anne would have a far greater influence upon her daughter than has long been supposed. Even at her young age, Elizabeth already resembled her. She would also inherit some of her mother's personal traits: tenacity, self-discipline, and charisma. Equally, there would be flashes of Anne's cruelty and vindictiveness. But above all, it would be the example provided by Anne's life that would prove the greatest of all her legacies to Elizabeth. From this, her daughter learned not to trust expressions of love and devotion. She learned to guard her reputation fiercely, and she learned to be a self-reliant, political pragmatist. Anne had had qualities that would have made her a great queen, but she had also had a number of fatal flaws. It was in learning from both that Elizabeth was able to become the queen that her mother was never able to be. Her final speech over, Anne knelt on the scaffold with great composure and commended her soul to God. With a clean strike, Anne's head was severed from her body. For her daughter Elizabeth, just 2 years and 8 months old, life would never be the same again.
And tomorrow, Emma Fielding reads the second extract from Elizabeth's Women by Tracy Borman. It's been abridged by Katie Nicol, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.